So let's talk about the book, the wonderful book. How old were you when you first read it? Can you remember?
Yeah, I mean, I think my mom read it to me, so the main thing I remember is just her voice and reading the intonation in which you read the dialogue and whatever the story, and then the pictures, you know, the wild things, and the bull with the human feet, which I seemed really strange to me, and the wild things themselves.
So what was it about the story that kind of touched you as a child and then continued to touch you throughout your life, and about Maurice himself? Why has he been so influential and inspirational to you?
I feel like he's been influential to me in like a few different points in my life, and like, I think as a kid he was influential in this sort of, and in a way that I didn't obviously know at the time, but just like just being excited by the images he drew, and like, you know, in excited by these wild things, and you know, or in the night kitchen where the little boy falls out of his bed through the floor and through the ceiling and through the floor of the next, you know, apartment, and out of his pajamas and lands in this dough in this night kitchen, and just images like that just seemed magical, and then I think in my early 20s I got into directing music videos, and I'd always sort of go back and look at those books in the night kitchen where the wild things are, and think about like just how perfect they were, these little short stories, and always sort of aspiring to make music videos that were that sort of complete and magical and imaginative. And then again, and then when we started working on this, I got to know Maurice actually about 13 years ago, and we talked about this over the years, but we only started working on it about 5 years ago. And then in this, working on it with him, we really, I think he sort of, he inspired me again in another way, sort of just how fiercely independent he is, and fiercely protective of his work, and fiercely protective of children. And when I started working on the movie, the one thing he said was that it was important. It wasn't important to him if I was like really overly reverential to the book. He wanted me to just make something that was personal to me, in the same way the book was personal to him when he was my age. And he wanted me to make sure I didn't pander to children, and I took children seriously. And so that was the only thing he was really fiercely imperative about for my trip. This is a good vocabulary.
I mean, there's 338 words in that story, and it's a 101-minute movie. So how did you sort of simply begin opening up the world? I mean, tell us about the process. I think you spent like 6 months before you even kind of approached Dave Eggers to write the script with you.
Yeah.
Just kind of working on the project, thinking about it. So if you can just tell us that process, it'd be very interesting.
I think, you know, for a while I was hesitant to make a movie of it, and I talked to Maurice about it a couple times before, because anytime I started thinking about it, I love the book so much, and it seemed so perfect. And as I started thinking about like what would happen, what kind of plot or story you'd add on to it, it just seemed like that doesn't belong to the movie. That's like me trying to add some idea onto it. And so a few times twice before when we talked about it, I ended up saying, you know, I don't know how to do this. And then the third time he approached me, I started thinking about it differently, where I started thinking more about who the wild things were and who Max was. And I think the idea that I had was that the wild things were wild emotions, and once I had that idea that the wild things were wild emotions, and I could just expand on what that means to when you're 9 years old, in terms of, you know, how overwhelming and scary it can be, in terms of unpredictable emotions in you and in people around you, and how there's the someone's phone ringing. Can I tell a story really quick? My friend was in a play, and they were all on stage, and the phone, and they heard they were acting out the play, and somebody's phone rang, and they're like, and it kept ringing, and then they heard somebody say, "Yeah, hello. Yeah, I'm in a play right now. I can't talk." And first week into this play, but it took me for months. But anyways, I hope I'm getting a good review of the book. But anyways, again, I'm not sure what I'm saying.
About the wild emotions. Actually, I want to ask you about the names. Where do the names come from? Do they have any sort of deep significance or meaning? And what does KW stand for?
I think they just, they're more, I think the initial idea was that we would give them very normal names, and the normal names are sort of things that just, I mean, like, they just seemed right to us as we were writing. I mean, I don't know if there's a specific meaning that would mean anything to anyone else. It was more just like, it felt right to me.
Now, can we talk about the wonderful Max Records? Because, you know, he's critical to the movie, and he's just fantastic. And it was Catherine Keever, I think, found him, because she'd been helping search for the children. You'd spent...
Yeah, she didn't find him, but she on this movie was sort of our creative partner, where, you know, she was from the beginning would audition kids with me. The two of us would go in and read scenes with kids, and when we did the voice shoot with all the voice actors, we had a big sound stage in Los Angeles before we went to Australia and shot the movie. We shot the whole movie on video with the seven actors, the seven voice actors all in a room together, and we wanted to get the sort of naturalism of the way you put, when you put an ensemble of actors together, and how when, you know, sort of something bigger than just the two lines of dialogue happen, there's sort of the interaction of actors, you know, acting together, and so anyways, she was with us along that way, like in that situation. Her and I switched off playing Max with all the voice actors, and so she was sort of a partner all the way through. But I don't exactly know, you know, she gave up so much time to this thing. It was something she just wanted to do and was excited about the movie and was important to her. And her agent thought she was insane because she was down in Australia with us for 5 months, and she had 2 weeks of shooting the scenes, and the rest of the time she was just working with us. But Max was found by a friend of mine, Lance Bangs, who's a documentarian in Portland, Oregon. And we'd gotten pretty far into, you know, pretty close to shooting. We still hadn't found the boy, the actor who's going to carry the whole movie. And as we were auditioning, we were realizing how complex the character we'd written was. We'd written this character with many sides and many colors, and we'd find some kids that could play the sort of more internal side really well, and other kids that could play the wild side really well, and nobody that could sort of play all the sides. And my friend Lance found him in Portland and put him on tape, and when we first saw him, he just, you know, he's so, you know, just really compelling to look at.
Who's Max?
And his name is Max, too. His name is Max Records, which was fortunate.
You had an unusual way of directing him, I believe, setting up stunts and explosions.
Yeah, I didn't want it to be like a movie kid. I didn't want it to be like a movie kid. I didn't want it to be a movie kid acting. And we also didn't want it to be like a special effects kind of acting, where you're like putting the actor in front of a, you know, whatever, a green screen, and say, okay, over this is happening, over here this is happening, and now cry, now laugh. And so we created, we couldn't always have off camera the stuff, you know, we could have like a wild thing throw another wild thing or whatever was happening off camera, so we would often give something else for him to react to. It would be similar, and we'd, you know, spray the costume designer with a fire extinguisher to get Max to laugh, or whatever it was, we'd sort of come up with these little plays we'd do behind camera to engage Max.
And did you learn to swallow fire?
Badly. Yeah. Which freaked him out, which was a good reaction.
Well, listen, I'm going to throw it open to you now. If you have a question, put your hand up. I will point to you, and then a microphone will come down. I can't believe... Yes. Just to your left.
Technical question. As a filmmaker, we've been encouraged not to do stuff. We've encouraged kids to hit each other on the head, because apparently some kids have slightly weak skulls. They reach a certain age. And I wondered what discussions you'd had around that and what age group the movie's aimed at.
Did you say, as filmmakers, you're taught not to?
Yeah.
Who taught these?
I once had someone from the Board of Film Classification sort of go agree with me that they've got a view about there are certain things they like to interfere with, and two of which is kids hanging themselves, the other one's each other on the head, that they've got some reservations about.
Quite rightly, one assumes.
So you're not supposed to film kids hitting each other on the head, okay? I didn't know. No.
kids were harmed in this film.
I didn't go to that class. That's the problem. I don't know. This film was just trying to capture what it feels like to be 9 years old. And I think there's a lot of, kids are not politically correct. I think that they haven't been taught that. And so we were trying to represent that when, Max says, Max's leg is caught under a lot of things. Like, my leg's caught under this fat guy, and they haven't been taught that you're not supposed to, if you're in a supermarket and you're with a little kid and you're like, oh, why does that guy only have one arm? And, they don't know. They're just, so I think we're just trying to capture that feeling.
Well, Maurice says that his books are about children, not for children. Would you say the same is true of the movie? Is that how you...
Yeah, it's not that it's not for children, is that making sense? It's trying to be about childhood and trying to be honest. And I think that's why, I think back on the book, on Where the Wild Things Are, when I read it, there was something that just felt, I related to. It felt, it wasn't, in the book, it got attacked a lot when the book came out. It was attacked a lot by like child psychologists and librarians, and the way Maurice tells it was really upsetting to him because he got in a lot of trouble. There's articles written about him and stuff, and the book was said, these child psychologists said, it was dangerous for children because it has monsters, and because the boy gets upset and the mom, instead of, gets upset also, instead of like being calm and staying calm and helping him with his feelings, she yells at him and sends him to the room. I don't think as a kid, you don't even judge that. It's like, that's real.
Yeah,
and
sure.
you relate to that, and you escape into the world that Max escapes into. And I think I think that, that was what, we were just trying to, as Maurice said from the beginning, to take kids seriously.
Did you ever ask him about the human feet on the ball? Because that bothered me as a child as well.
Yeah, no, I never did.
Okay. There was another guy at the back there. Please,
first of all. Where the Wild Things Are, I loved as a child, and I want to say thank you so much for making it into a beautiful film. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Also, it was a brilliant choice to make the wild things themselves, people in suits, rather than just CGI creatures. Now, a lot of filmmakers would say, oh, we'll do that CGI, but you haven't. But what you have done is you've made their faces CGI. I want to ask, are you kind of telling people, like, okay, this is the way I really think CGI should be used, only on features that are necessary, not like the whole package, like Jar Jar Binks or something? Is that what you're kind of saying here? Are you saying this is how CG should be used?
No, I think, I guess it was more, the decision more was coming from capturing the feel, that what would give me the feeling that I really wanted the movie to feel like, and I wanted it to feel like Max was really there with these creatures on this island. You feel the sand in their hair and the light coming through their fur, and them being able to bump into him, hug him, like just that visceral quality that would make it feel like he really went there and he really, and it would also give this sort of danger to it, that he is there and that something could happen to him. And really, by extension, just taking the character seriously. The whole, the whole intention was this was to write a character that where we took this person that's 9 years old seriously, and then filmed it in a way that was taking him seriously. And so, this place is a place he goes to. We wanted him really to go there, and the camera to feel like it was just with him, trying to capture what he was seeing as he was trying to take it all in. The camera was trying to take it all in, And so I think it really just came from, emotionally what we wanted it to feel like.
Can you talk about a little bit about the sort of changing the pivotal sort of scene, the kind of point of entry into the Wild Things world? Because obviously in the book, the jungle grows up here, he kind of he runs away.
Yeah, yeah, and that was I think it took a long time to really, like, it was something I kind of knew didn't feel right, but I was also really insecure about making that change because it's something that I loved from the book. And as a kid, I remember just being sort of hypnotized by those pages and, like, you know, where like the bedposts grow up into trees and the wallpaper sort of slowly falls off into the leaves and he walks through the forest. And but in the movie, as I was writing the script, I kind of had that inkling and I started talking to Dave about it, and that I wanted, it felt wrong to have a visual effect take Max to the island as opposed to Max in his own burst of emotions take himself to the island. And so that's sort of what led it, you know, what led us down that road.
And that's the one thing that Maurice had a problem with, wasn't it? He can't convince you to change it, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he would always say, look, you got to make your movie, do whatever you want, but can it be the bedroom turning into the forest? And then he would... so we would sort of debate that, but he was always very respectful of, you know, me making my movie. And the great thing, the thing that meant a lot too, was when we were in Australia, we'd every week send him a DVD of what we shot that week. And when we sent him that sequence of Max getting in a fight with his mom and running through the streets, he called me on, it was on a Saturday, and he said, you know, he just watched this, you know, that whole week of TV, or that whole day, you know, DVD of those dailies, and thought, and he understood it, and he saw it, and thought he had taken this idea and made it cinematic, and he really was moved by it. And that was a really important phone call, because other than that, he'd been really supportive, and even with that, he was really supportive. But I knew. He was saying, okay, yeah, do your thing, but I could tell it's like giving a little like pang in his heart that if we had changed it. And so to get that call and that sort of approved was meaningful.
Yes.
Hello. It's a bit of a nerdy film question, really. But very early on in the film was a moment when Max is told he's got no friends, and we've gone a close-up of Max, and a train goes past. And I'm wondering if that was your idea, the sound designer's idea, and were there other tricks where you use sound or vision to try to make concrete Max's internal emotions?
Yeah, that wasn't my idea, it was the sound designer's idea, but I loved it. Our sound designer is named Rain Kleiss, and I'd worked with him on lots of things before, and he's just somebody who is this, like, he is very childlike himself in, like, his appreciation of things and his enthusiasm of things, and especially when it comes to sound. I've been with him, like, in an elevator or in the middle of conversation, he's like, did you hear that? And there's some, there's, like, just the sound of, like, the sort of spring going by or something, and so he is, like, he's this very, this, like, intuitive artist, and he loves sound, and so it couldn't be a better job for him. It's like one of those things where he was taking apart tape recorders when he was 6 years old, and always loved sound. And he worked that way a lot. He just always brought a lot of ideas and like sound design. A lot of things that were like sort of sound design as score in, you know, like moments in on the forest where there'd be tension building, and he'd be using just these sort of cicada crickets, you know, kind of background sound building up, and then when instead of having score building up and then stopping, he would have crickets go up and then stop in a moment where like everyone stands still and there's a moment of dramatic pause or whatever. It's like there's a lot of sound design that he really sculpted, and really the whole movie is an incredible amount of sound design, because once Max leaves his house, the only audio that we recorded on location is Max's voice, and other than that, everything else was created and dubbed by the voice actors.
Now, it's about the visual look of the film, because it's very naturalistic, very realistic, very handheld. And as soon as you see kind of Magic Hour, you think of Terry Malick. So can you just talk about you know, the process, the inspiration for that, you know, look?
Well, I mean, some of it goes back to just wanting it to feel real, but specific to, like, Magic Hour and the photography. I guess one thing was the nature, the production design-wise, we knew we wanted it to be real, but we also wanted to maintain the graphic nature of the book and how you know the scale of the book, how big the Wild Things are next to Max, and the sort of graphic quality of the illustrations. And so we tried to find locations that were all graphic, and like the forest itself was a burned out forest that had all the undergrowth had burned out about 6 months earlier, so it was just charred black trunks and black ground. And so KK, our production designer, found that and said, "This is, I think, where we should shoot because it's like it's like a empty palette. Is that the right word? Empty canvas. Oh, canvas." And so then he went in and you know, sprinkled white leaves on the ground and put this sort of layer of haze, like a few hundred yards back, and sort of became this sort of black sticks against this white haze, and then went in and sort of put these like saplings with little yellow and white. Little sapling leaves, and it became, and so that became sort of MO is just go in and like art direct nature, find stunning locations and art direct them in a really simple way, and do little things that make big statements, and then in terms of the other thing we realized as we were going into it, it was our assistant director Thomas Smith pointed out that we didn't have a lot of cover sets because we weren't shooting indoors a lot once we left the house, the home life stuff. And that was the first 2 weeks. We had very little interior things for cover, and we were going to run out of cover sets. And so we just made the decision of whatever happens, we will incorporate into the movie, and that will be part of the philosophy of the movie. So if we get somewhere and it's raining or storming or windy or whatever it is, we would just take that and use that. And that became the, we thought the sort of wild, you know, the having a sort of geographical wildness and weather wildness and, we just sort of add to it, and we started sort of just embracing when we got light, we got light, and when we didn't get light, and it sort of adds to like you know the days and the nights sort of all blend together, and you know that's why there's so many sunrises and sunsets. It's sort of you know just like wow, this is beautiful. Let's just shoot this, even though you know it doesn't make sense time wise, and I think it's sort of, you know, and I mean, this could be justifying after the fact, but there's a line in the book that like, days tumbled into nights, and so I'm holding that onto that as my justification.
Did you shoot day for night?
We did. We had day for night and night for night, but we had quite a bit of day for night, too.
Okay, another question? Anybody? Yeah, the guy in the center? A bit further down? Guy with a beard?
When you're talking about the logo and being allowed to get away with it, you talked of disagreements and problems with, I guess, creative freedom on the project. How were there things that you weren't allowed to do or disagreements that you didn't win, or did you win most of the battles that you had?
Yeah, we made the movie we wanted to make. We didn't. There was a period where we were editing and we showed the studio the film and they were kind of surprised by the feel of it, and I think they were expecting something that felt more like a traditional children's film, and but you know we got through that period and you know, didn't let the sort of all the sort of studio anxieties interfere with the movie, I never really go into details about it because it was just like you know well, he said this and they said this and I said this and they said this but you know, for like as Catherine Keener always just sums it up, and it was fucked up, and now it's better. We got to make the movie, and we didn't compromise it in that period. And the other thing is, like, the movie was like 5-year process, and that was about 5 months in the middle of it, so it wasn't like the whole thing was in that period.
That kind of sums up childhood. It was fucked up, and it's better.
Yeah.
Another question. The other guy, third row from the back. You have your hand up quickest. Yeah, you. Keep your hand up, please, so they can put the mic down.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk about the writing. Sort of specifically, why you, at what point you decided not to write it on your own, and like why you chose specifically Dave Eggers and sort of how you sort of divide up the labour. Did you sort of allocate him to do a particular thing, things like that?
Well, early on, I knew I wanted to write it with somebody. Partially just for that I didn't want to sit in the room by myself, but partially because I just knew I'd feed off of somebody else. It'd be more fun and more like there would be more energy there. Early on, after I decided that, I think Dave was probably the first person I thought of, and Dave was somebody I knew for a long time. His first book, Heartbreaking Work of a Staggering Genius, he'd sent me to make it with a letter asking if I wanted to make a movie of it, and I love that book, but I didn't know how to make that into a movie. But through that, we became friends, and he's somebody I always thought, oh, this is somebody I want to work with on something, and I didn't ever think about a screenplay because he'd never written a screenplay before. But then when I thought of a writer, I thought of Dave, and a lot of people in the movie hadn't really done what they'd done before, and I think that part of the spirit of the movie is to, you know, there's this sort of, you know, wanting, like, the way Ren works, like, the sound designer I was talking about, like, he's very intuitive and just has a feeling, and I wanted people like that involved in the movie as much as possible, as opposed to, like, you know, professionals that were going to, you know, that maybe would have approached it in a way they might have approached something else before. And so I thought Dave would bring something exciting to it. And I love his writing, and in his first book he wrote, and actually the book What is the What, he writes about childhood and captures the internal life of you know, what it feels like to be a kid really well. But a lot of people that work on the movie, our character designer Sonny was somebody whose illustrations I really loved. And he was somebody that, when we needed a character designer, we started working, a lot of the stuff was coming back kind of looking like trolls or looking like other monsters you'd seen. And Sonny, I found Sonny's drawings through Karen and her friend. And Sonny had these drawings of these really sad bears sitting against trees. And they were perfect and funny and had pathos. And so we brought Sonny on. At first just to do sketches, and then slowly we just made him the character designer, and he worked very closely with the Jim Henson Company to build the suits and get the look that we wanted. And then we had, on the first day, or the first few days of shooting, when we first started shooting The Wild Things, we shot with Alexander, and the actress we had inside the costume of the goat, Alexander, wasn't really working, and so we needed somebody else that was small and sort of funny and sarcastic and disgruntled, and Sonny was all of those things. And so we put him in the suit, and he was really funny. And so we left him in the suit for 4 months, and he was just really funny.
So if you recorded all the voices beforehand, did the people in the suits speak the voices? Did you have a playback in there?
Oh, the whole thing like sort of depended on what the scene was. But we do a lot of things where we have big speakers playing out the dialogue, and we hear like Gandolfini, Forrest Whitaker, and Paul Dano's voices echoing through the sets. And they'd be acting along with them, and or sometimes they'd do the lines direct, sometimes we do takes with Gandolfini. And also we had this very complex sound system playback where we would, you know, we could recut the dialogue and like add pauses or overlap depending on, because all the timing of the dialogue changed with the blocking of the sets, and the scene would, you know, might take longer to get over, or might take a while longer to stand up and deliver the second half of this line, or whatever it was.
Guy in the front row, if you can run down, please. This one first of all, then the other guy after.
It's been said quite a few times that the studio wanted a children's film, whereas you made a film about childhood. Was that originally your intention, and also what do you think the difference actually is?
That was always our intention. I think there's just things that were rough around the edges, it didn't feel safe in the way that Max is. It's emotionally intense, and I think that's not doesn't sort of go with what they would expect, I think. I mean, in terms of like the things they honed in on that they didn't like.
Were there any kind of other kids' movies that you particularly gravitated to that kind of inspired you? I think 400 Blows is one that you...
Yeah. 400 Blows was one that was we watched again when we were writing. We watched Black Stallion, E.T., a few others, a Rat Catcher, but like movies that were like very much told from a kid's point of view and the world seen from a kid's point of view and trying to capture, you know, trying to check films that you know, were sort of inspiring in the way they captured that.
Did you find that very easy to kind of to regress back to a 9-year-old? Because it seems effortless when you see the film.
I think once, you know, once you're sort of writing that every day, that's where you, you know, that's where your head goes, and you sort of, you know, you're, and by living it every day, it helps.
Because you interviewed a whole bunch of kids as well, didn't you? Was that before the writing process?
That was after the writing, but we kind of wanted to make sure that we weren't, like, you know, that we were remembering it right. And the kids were as sort of, you know, funny and strange and deep and you know, and complicated as we had imagined. Remember?
Yes.
Hi, Spike. I'm curious to know. I don't know if you still do, but if you still read the book, and if you do, do you look at it the same way you did as a kid?
Well, I right now I've read the book so many times and it's so sort of intertwined with making a movie for so long, but I don't, it's my memories are all the immediate memories of it, and like, you know, when we were writing, we went to the coffee shop and made big blow-ups of it and taped it all on the wall, and, you know, we sort of feed off of those feelings that we had, and so it's like we've sort of, at this point, like, sucked all our memories dry of the book and created new memories. But I don't know, I'd be interested, maybe in 5 or 10 years, if I read the book again, I'll maybe be able to tap back into that again.
Yeah, lots of questions. Okay, the lady right at the back. And then if you pass it along to the person in the back row, to wait. Yeah, you first.
Hi. You've been involved quite a lot with sort of the skateboarding scene, and where you've made decks with other characters from this film. I was wondering how your actual involvement with making skateboard videos and things affected what actually happened there, how you actually made it, and what it ended up looking like.
What was the question? Sorry.
Sorry.
Was it the editing?
Just the whole atmosphere. Like, there seemed to be a lot to do with like the whole skate scene and
how skateboard videos.
Yeah, like, just the roughness of it all seemed to be. I mean, and obviously you've made decks of it, and sort of the whole like physicality. I thought, I don't know. It seemed like they were quite close together to me. But
yeah,
I was wondering if you could say something about that.
Yeah, I'm sure there is an influence because, you know, you know, skateboarding and my friends at skateboard and that I skateboard with and the videos we make, that's a big part of my life, and I'm not sure if I could analyze exactly what the influence is, but I'm sure it's there, and I agree with you that it's probably there.
Hi, I was really interested in the melancholy that really pervades the film. I like the fact that the melancholy didn't really let up even towards the end, but the monsters are still fairly miserable, and Max leaves the island, and although he reconciles with his mother, it's not a big Hollywood moment where he comes back and relates everything that he's learned. And I wondered whether it was important for you to have an ending that wasn't downbeat necessarily, but felt perhaps more emotionally subdued than perhaps the big Hollywood film that you were pressured to make.
I think that the ending is the moment that's happening at the end is definitely something I pictured very early on, and it was important to me, and it just felt authentic. I'm not sure what else, you know, I could say about it.
Do you want to talk about the choice of music? Why Karen? And then, you know, how that sort of organically.
Yeah, Karen, when I was writing the script, I knew I wanted her to write the music, and she's somebody who writes, again, just from her heart, and it's not, she doesn't write analytically at all, she just writes whatever she's feeling, and she's somebody that's really has this powerful ability to, like, you know, and I've seen her in the studio and watched her, and she's like, she has whatever she's feeling, she kind of closes her eyes and goes into that feeling and writes a song about that, and everybody around there sort of gets sucked into this stream of hers, and she keeps her eyes closed, or I mean, it feels like her eyes are closed until this, you know, she opens her eyes and completed this song, and I just wanted, again, she's just able to, I wanted to have that, I thought that would be really powerful to have, and also we talked about pop songs, Karen and I talked about how when we were kids we loved pop songs, and the song Stand By Me, or like, I remember like Gloria Gaynor, I Will Survive, like, I remember as a kid thinking, like, loving that song, and I think that like as a kid, you don't, as a kid it's not like I understood, and it's not like I'd experienced, I don't think I'd experienced like getting dumped by a man and in a house by, you know, by myself and like picking myself up and I Will Survive. But but as a kid I think you still relate to the idea of being lonely and sad and making and being triumphant and feeling you can do anything despite that. And like, so I think as a kid you like pop songs are really, you really connect to pop songs, and like I see other, like I see friends of mine, my friend's son, like, sing an Arcade Fire song, My Body is a Cage, and he's this 8-year-old kid missing half his teeth, and he's just singing it in the backseat of the car, just facing out, looking out the window, and he loves that song, and he, like, relates to the song about being trapped in your body and not being able to express yourself, and I don't know if he thinks about that, he relates it, but he, the way he sings the music, and so I think, I thought, like, it was boring when my grandparents put it on, and so I thought that that made sense, that like not to score Max's movie with like classical music, but with songs.
Okay, I think probably time for a couple more. That guy there, please.
Hello, Spy. Just a quick question. Not all that serious, I'm afraid. But what was your favourite sandwich to eat on set during the film, and how do you think that might have affected the way the film ended up?
I like. There's a sandwich of like ham and mozzarella and olive oil and on sourdough bread, and I think that it probably affected the film by making it hammy. Well, speaking of hammy, actually, that's a good transition into this thing that. That I was telling Mark about, that I brought this short film that is very hammy that I'll show you guys right now. We can't show it. That's right. I can't act it out because that would be really embarrassing. I'll just tell you what it was. It was, anyways. Sorry that I lied to you. Yeah, thank you. But anyways, I was going to show you this movie we made for Maurice Sendak's birthday, where he turned 80, and we wanted, Catherine Keener and I wanted to make him a present, and so we made him this movie where a couple years earlier I'd interviewed him, and he told a story about when he went to the World's Fair when he was 6 or 7 or 8, and his sister had been forced to take him, and so his sister and her boyfriend took him to the World's Fair, and they ditched him. And he was really upset, and the police ended up taking him home. And when they got to the cop's house, when the cops got to his house, the dad opened the door, and the sister was back there all, you know, cowering. And Maurice like, she did this to me, she did this. And the mom and the dad turned around and slapped his sister. And then Maurice was like, and that was the best day of my life. But anyway, we made a recreation of that I can't show you.
But it's good. One final question. Please let it not be food related. Or maybe it can.
I was just interested in the location. I thought the location was amazing. It looked really wild, really isolated, and it was just the right atmosphere. And I was wondering if you'd actually seriously considered anywhere else as a location. So I know you're talking about finding Max in Portland, and it seems to me that kind of the Oregon coastline was this kind of in my imagination, that kind of thing.
Actually, we did consider Oregon. Oregon has some amazing coastlines, and we considered some of Northern California. We considered Chile. One idea we had was like flying all over the world and like doing a little bit everywhere and like going to Iceland, and like that went out the window really early. Our producer's like, "What are you talking about?" But as we sort of went, all this stuff, it sort of boiled down to like New Zealand and Australia seemed to have a lot of what we needed, and in the end we chose Melbourne because they had sound stages that we needed, and actually it was the burned out forest that KK found that sort of was outside of Melbourne that was the final thing. But they were all like locations sort of on that southern coast of Australia.
Please put your hands together for Spike Jonze.